In lots of areas of life, it's very tempting to look for magic bullets, isn't it? When you want to achieve something, it's tempting to think you'll be able to find one technique that'll nail it for you. Witness all the books that start with the secret to such and such, the secret to losing weight, the secret to stopping smoking, the secret to success. There's one thing, one technique that you've missed. When you got it, when you've got that mindset, it's going to change things. That's why we love buying new gadgets, isn't it? Because that device is going to make me 10 times more productive just by owning it. It applies to Christian living as well, I think. Don't we imagine sometimes there's a magic bullet out there that's going to transform discipleship? If only we could start thinking of God in this way, not that way, our experience would be different. I think there's a danger we might think that when we come to Hebrews 3. Is the writer offering us a magic bullet? 3:1, we've thought about it already. Beloved of cards and posters, fix your thoughts on Jesus, he says. I think it'd be very easy to treat that like a magic bullet. If only I can start doing that, which I'm not now, if only I can start living a fixing my eyes on Jesus life, then it'll all be very different. I once heard a Christian leader say in an interview, he said his Christian life used to be a bit dull, a bit joyless, and then he realised that he wasn't spending time every day adoring Christ as Lord. So this is what he said. He said, it's crazy that we don't do this. What you need to do is spend an hour a day just adoring Jesus as Lord. And I was a student and I thought, well, that sounds about right. That must be true. Sounds good. You know, why? I can't believe I haven't been doing this. So I sat down at my desk to adore Jesus as Lord for an hour. And I didn't have a clue what I was supposed to be doing. What does that mean? How do I do that? Shall I pray? Shall I read my Bible? Shall I sing? Yes, maybe. Shall I try all those things? Am I thinking about Jesus? Yes, I am. Am I adoring him? Am I fixing my eyes on him? I guess so. Here's the problem. If we read Fix Your Thoughts on Jesus like it is an extra thing to do that we haven't been doing, like it's a brilliant discipleship strategy we've been missing out on, like it's the kind of really advanced thing that some people manage to do, but I'm not quite there yet. Well, I don't think that's what the author had in mind. That's not his purpose when he writes this. I think what he's saying here, fitting in with what he's saying in his whole letter, is fix your thoughts on Jesus, because that's what it means to be Christian. We could translate that word, consider. Fix your thoughts on, consider, contemplate Jesus, because that's what it is to be Christian. As we mentioned earlier with the children, he's already been making us do what he's asking us to do. We've been considering Jesus. We've been thinking hard about Jesus since the beginning of the letter. If you've been here in the past couple of weeks, last week in chapter 2, we thought about Jesus becoming human to fulfill our destiny to rule the world. Jesus raising us up to reign with him. And he moves on, chapter 3, where we are, which we read this morning. Therefore, holy brothers and sisters who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus. Think about Jesus. Chapter 3, if you like, is a moment of application. And he's going to do a positive and a negative. We're looking at the positive in these 6 verses this morning. Fix your thoughts on Jesus. Do fix your thoughts on Jesus. The rest of the chapter has the other side. Don't, the negative. Don't fall away. That's the stark opposition he's putting up. You can be fixing your thoughts on Jesus, or you can be falling away. The whole letter is written to exhort them to stay on that side. Stay fixing your eyes on Jesus. And his strategy is to make them do that, to write a whole letter that makes them think about Jesus, that gives them no choice but to look at Jesus. I think what he's doing here in this verse, this section, It's like when the actor turns to the audience and addresses them, breaking that third wall, letting them in on what's going on. He's saying, by the way, guys, I'm making you look at Jesus. Look at Jesus. And it helps us, because even though that's what the whole Christian life is about, it helps to be reminded of that. It helps to be shown why that is the case. So our goal in these few minutes together, looking at these verses, is to think about Jesus together. It's to think about Jesus and to think about why the whole Christian life is all about thinking about Jesus. And what I hope to achieve is not so much that we go off and do a whole lot of different things this week, not that we try and implement the magic technique that will change things, but that we're reminded of the shape of the Christian life, that it is all inwards towards Jesus. And then maybe, therefore, that we do the same things a bit more consciously. Maybe we're able to work with the grain of those things that we are doing. Now, if you're here and you're not a Christian this morning, what a great week to have come. We love to have people in that situation. This is it. This is the fundamental. This is the heart of what it means to be Christian. What a great week to have come and to listen with us. Two reasons then, on the outline, why the Christian life is all about considering Jesus. Because of who he is to us, and because of who we are to him. We'll take them in turn. Because of who Jesus is to us. And the first sub-point there is that Jesus is essential. He is essential. This comes out of those two titles that Jesus is given in verse 1. Fix your thoughts on Jesus, verse 1, whom we acknowledge as our apostle and high priest. Why describe Jesus as an apostle and as a high priest? Well, I think these two titles highlight for us how Jesus is essential to every aspect of Christian experience. He's essential to the whole reality of Christianity. He is essential to the whole existence of God's people. Think about it in turn. Apostle. An apostle, that's a New Testament title. An apostle is someone who is sent with a message. At the end of the service, we will send an apostle to Emmanuel Kids to say, you can come back in. It's the last song. Someone sent with a message. In the New Testament, the apostles, the 12 of them, they're people sent by Jesus to give his message to the church. And that gives them special authority. Their words have authority like no one else's. They're the central human leaders of God's people in the New Testament. The most important ones. They are Jesus' apostles, but there's a sense in which we could say Jesus is an apostle, especially given what we've been reading in Hebrews so far. Remember chapter 1, or flick back there if you've not been with us. Chapter 1 of Hebrews, and the very beginning. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets in many times in various ways, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, who is, we read in verse 3, the exact representation of his being. Jesus is the one who's come from God the Father to us with a message. He's the one come from God to perfectly communicate God the Father to us. The apostles of Jesus, they're key to us hearing God's message, but only because they speak Jesus' words. They pass on his message. As Jesus is the apostle par excellence. And that means he's utterly crucial to the church hearing from God. As far as movement from God to his people is concerned, communication, it is all about Jesus. That's interesting, because this other title, high priest, that's about movement in the opposite direction. High priest, that's an Old Testament title, so we have Old Testament and New Testament covered. The high priest is the one who represents the people before God. The high priest goes into the temple, he goes to God on behalf of the people to bring their offerings to him. And it all goes through him, that one person. He's the one human appointed to go before God for the people. The most important spiritual leader in the Old Testament. And that is Jesus. He is, says the writer, our apostle and our high priest. The Old Testament, New Testament, movement from God to his people, movement from the people to God. It is all about Jesus. And actually, it could only be all about Jesus, because he's the only one who can do those two jobs perfectly. Only someone who's fully God and fully man could do this. That's what we were thinking about again last week in chapter 2, that Jesus has come to be fully man while remaining fully God. And verse 17 of chapter 2, we read, he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest. Only a human could do that job of high priest. Only a human could represent humanity before God. I can't become an ambassador for the United States because I'm not a US citizen. I would have to be one of them in order to represent them to others. Jesus has to become part of humanity to represent us before God. But only by being fully God at the same time can he be a perfect high priest who never dies and fails in his job. And that's something the writer's going to tell us about later in his letter. Actually, the same is true of being an apostle, of carrying the authoritative message from God to his people. Only by becoming human could Jesus completely represent God to us. God comes down to our level in the most complete way to communicate with us. Again, chapter 1, we read, he's spoken to us by his Son. Jesus is the message from God that could be said in no other way. You see, the whole existence and life of God's people, that two-way process, God's words to his people, God's people's representation before him, is all coming through Jesus. It only could be about Jesus. It's utterly central to what it means for God to have a people who relate to him. That is why we make a big deal of Jesus. He is essential. He's also faithful, like Moses. Let's have a look at verse 2. He was faithful to the one who appointed him, just as Moses was faithful in all God's house. So that Jesus does a good job of these two roles has been kind of obvious from the letter so far. He's been a faithful apostle. He has come. That's what an apostle does. He comes, he takes the message, and he speaks it. Well, Jesus has come. Chapter 1 and chapter 2. He's become man. He's spoken the message. He's communicated God. He's been a faithful apostle. And he's been a faithful high priest. Chapter 2, we read, he made atonement. Verse 17, he made atonement for the sins of the people. He made us one with God by his death. He did it. He died. He made the sacrifice. He was given two jobs, two roles. And he faithfully accomplished them. And the writer underlines that by comparing him with Moses, just as Moses was faithful. There's a reference back to an Old Testament passage in Numbers 12, where God himself describes Moses as faithful in all his house. Now that comparison with Moses may not impress us very much, because Moses may not be a very big deal to us, but it would have impressed his original readers. They're from a Jewish background, and for them, Moses is the benchmark in terms of leadership. He's the benchmark in terms of faithfulness. A bit like Roger Federer in tennis. Roger Federer, 12 Grand Slams, 27 Grand Slam finals, world number one for 237 consecutive weeks, 6 World Tour titles, World Sportsman of the Year 4 years in a row, $100 million in prize money, I could go on. His Wikipedia page is pretty long. He's the benchmark. So if you say of someone, well, he's quite a good tennis player, a bit like Roger Federer, that is quite some comparison to make. That's not just good, that's the top. Moses is the bar for greatness. Moses went up before Pharaoh. Moses led the people through the Red Sea. Moses received the law on the mountain. Moses gave God's word to the people. Moses led the people through the desert. Moses wrote down the first five books of the Bible. To say that Jesus is faithful like Moses, that is as high praise as he can give. He's done a job so faithful, he ranks up there with the greatest. But in fact, he surpasses him. Jesus is not just faithful like Moses, he is greater than Moses. He is the builder. Verse 3, Jesus has been found worthy of greater honor than Moses. Just as the builder of a house has greater honor than the house itself. Builders get more glory than buildings. That's the illustration he uses. Is that not self-evidently true? We don't give architectural prizes to buildings. The ceremony isn't someone taking a golden cup and laying it carefully on the steps of the building and presenting the cup to the building. It's the architect who wins the prize. It's the builder who wins the prize. They're the ones, those humans who are responsible. They go up on the stage and collect the trophy. Something that's been made can't take the credit for its own existence. Something that's beautiful that's been made, well, any appreciation of that beauty goes to the maker. And actually, what the writer points out in verse 4 is that principle applies to the whole universe. For every house is built by someone, but God is the builder of everything. Every house was built by someone. Everything with a design had a designer. Everything that has been caused was caused by something. The universe was made, and for every beauty we observe in it, the maker is the one who deserves the glory. Lots of people, I guess, today assume that the personal in the universe reduces to the impersonal. Really, we are just bags of atoms. There was this impersonal stuff that happened to be hanging around. It collided in such a way as to eventually form people. But in the end, we are just stuff. The mind-matter problem is not really a problem. Mind is an illusion, and stuff is all there is. The Christian claim all the way through the Bible is that the opposite is true. The most real is the personal. At the root of everything, all the stuff is a person. The absolute person, God. All the matter, all the stuff we see around us is there because he chose personally to make it. And that is quite an aside. That's immensely significant, isn't it? It gives significance to the personal in life. And isn't that the level of life that really matters to us when we're not being philosophical? Our hopes, our human hopes and fears and pains and joys. Just look, just watch the city for 10 minutes. Go and stand by the bus station in town and watch it teeming with life. It's teeming with people. People going places, doing things. People with their hopes and fears and pains and joys. And that is, the Bible says, not just a meaningless happenstance. It's not just a layer that happens to have formed on the top of cold and hard stuff. It means something, because the universe is all about a person. God is the builder of everything. But actually, there's a house, a particular house in view in these verses. This illustration of builders and buildings is not just a good illustration, it's a metaphor. Verse 5, Moses was faithful as a servant in all God's house. God's house there in that Old Testament quotation means God's people. God's house is a phrase used to refer to God's people all through the Bible. Moses led God's people. He was a servant in God's house. But, verse 6, Christ is faithful as the Son over God's house. Jesus was faithful like Moses, like the bar for greatness, we've said. But the writer goes on, unlike Moses, he was not just another part of God's house. He wasn't faithful in God's house as servant, but, verse 6, over God's house as son. In a sense, Moses is just another brick in the wall, as the song goes. He's part of the house, even as he leads it. He's just another part of what's built. And that's quite something, because if you could have said anyone built Israel, you'd have said Moses. Israel wasn't Israel before Moses. It didn't exist as a distinct nation. He brought them out. He gave them the law. He judged their disputes. He, you could say, brought the nation together. And yet, in the end, he's still on the side of made, not maker. He's still part of the house that God built. But Jesus is the Son. Remember again, chapter 1 of Hebrews, speaking of Jesus, his Son, whom he appointed or heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. Jesus doesn't fall into the category of made, but of maker, not of building, but builder. And so, he is on a different plane to Moses, worthy of much greater honour. And in fact, Moses himself knew that. Verse 5, Moses was faithful as a servant in all God's house, bearing witness to what would be spoken by God in the future. Moses pointed forward. Jesus keeps saying this in the Gospels. He keeps saying repeatedly, Moses wrote about me. If you listened to Moses, you'd be looking at me. And so to be so impressed with Moses that we stick with him over Jesus, as the writers might have been tempted to do, as the readers might have been tempted to do, that would be like preferring the sign over the reality it's pointing to. We went to Thomas Land the other week, Thomas the Tank Engine Land, which was very exciting. There's a very big sign over the entrance with Thomas's face on it. Come, Thomas Land, this way, come on in. Imagine if Johnny, in his excitement, had got out at the entrance and stood looking at the sign all day. He'd have been pretty happy there. But if you understand what the sign is doing, then you will do what it's telling you to do, and you will go in. If you really appreciate Moses in all his greatness, you will go to the one he points to, Jesus. So where are we? Well, when it comes to Christians, Christianity, the Christian life, it's all about Jesus. He fulfills the essential roles of communicating God to us and bringing us to God. He does it as faithfully as the great Moses. In fact, he's on a completely different level to Moses. He's the Son. He's the one who brought his people into being. And that means there is no aspect of the Christian life that can function without Jesus. Want to hear from God? You've got to go to the words of Jesus. The Old Testament, which points forward to him. The New Testament, which is all about Jesus and his words. Want to speak to God? You've got to go through Jesus on the basis of what he has done. And the letter is going to keep going and tell us much more about those things. Doesn't that give us every reason, every reminder of every reason we have to love Jesus? To talk about Jesus like we love him. I think that's worth hearing again. It's worth being reminded of that. That can be a hard thing for us to do. It can be a hard thing for people to understand. And an easy thing for people to mock, our obsession with Jesus. That's an easy thing for people to mock. You might have heard people say things like, oh, you know, heaven's like a big party with Jesus, is it? Snigger, snigger. It's a very easy thing for people to mock. It is good for our confidence to remember why, yes, we do make a big deal of Jesus. Yes, Jesus, the human Jesus, who lived 2,000 years ago, the man, the Son of God, from eternity, who rules in heaven. We've got reason, because there could be no Christianity, no Christian experience, no God's people without it all being about him. It's good to be reminded because of the effect that has on others as well, I think. It strikes me that lots of the people in my Christian life who've affected me the most are the ones who speak of Jesus in terms of personal affection. Strikes me that, I guess, one of the things that will have a positive effect on my children following Jesus is if I speak about him in terms of personal affection. It's good also, just to note finally on this point, to be reminded of, because it makes us healthily wary of exalting human Christian leaders. Jesus so perfectly fulfill these roles. He so perfectly mediates between us and God in both directions. We have no need of anyone more in between. He's so central that making any other human Christian leader central can only take away from him, which is what has happened in history with the Pope, has it not? It's right to resist that. If Jesus is the centre, let's be careful not to set anyone else up as centre. The Christian life is all about considering Jesus because of who he is to us. Secondly, I want to move on and say more briefly, the Christian life is all about considering Jesus because of who we are to him. We look at, again, briefly at verse 1. Who are we to him? We're his siblings called to reign with him. Look at how the readers are described in verse 1. Therefore, holy brothers and sisters who share in the heavenly calling. That's direct reference back to what we've just looked at in chapter 2. Chapter 2 verse 11, if you glance back, both the one who makes people holy and those who are made holy are of the same family. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters. Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers. That's who we are if we're trusting him. We are Jesus' holy siblings, and we share in the heavenly calling, which was described in chapter 2, that destiny to rule the world, the calling that Jesus fulfilled for us, and is going to call us and catch us up to share with him. Really simple point, our identity is bound up with Jesus, utterly. When we think about what we are now as Christians, we're people Jesus has made holy. We're people whose destiny is to rule with Jesus. There's no way we can identify ourselves except by reference to Jesus. Isn't that true when you think about it? Some people don't like the term Christian, so they would call themselves followers of Jesus or disciples of Jesus. But you can't really find a successful description that doesn't have Jesus in it somewhere. Actually, it's a bit of a warning sign when people who want to identify with Christianity describe themselves in some other way than primarily with Jesus, like the Church of Latter-day Saints. We are his siblings, called to reign with him. Our identity is utterly bound up with him. We're also his people who confess him. Verse 1 speaks of fixing our thoughts on Jesus, whom we acknowledge as our apostle and high priest. I think the translations are a bit clearer, which put it like this instead. Fix your thoughts on Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession. The content of our confession is Jesus. What we believe, it is all about Jesus. I believe Jesus to be the apostle, the supreme message from God, the authoritative communication of what God's like and what God's doing. I believe Jesus to be high priest, the only way of access to God to be with God forever. If you've said that, that's it, isn't it? That is the Christian confession. Christians are the people who confess Jesus, and they're the people who go on confessing Jesus. Did you see that at the end of verse 6? We are his house if indeed we hold firmly to our confidence and the hope in which we glory. Our hope is Jesus, what he's said and what he's done. He is our confidence, and we stay Christians if we stay confessing him. It's not an optional extra. That's the definition. And that's what Hebrews is all about. Stick with Jesus. Carry on confessing Jesus. Carry on fixing your thoughts on Jesus. That is what we say to everyone who we meet, who comes in contact with our community, who wouldn't call themselves a Christian. We'd say, it's all about Jesus. And the best way to weigh up whether you think this is true or not is to look at Jesus. Examine the life of Jesus. Go on the Christianity Explored course, which spends all its time looking through Mark's Gospel at the life of Jesus. And the point for us, if we are Christians, is, well, carry on confessing Jesus. Not try and get it right this week, try and finally be a Jesus-centered person, but carry on confessing Jesus. Don't give up. Don't give up identifying as a Christian at work or at the school gates. Don't give up identifying yourself with Jesus, identifying as someone who follows and trusts and loves Jesus. Don't give up telling your children about Jesus, speaking to them the name of Jesus, speaking in terms of personal affection for Jesus around them. Holy brothers and sisters who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus.